Matthew chapter 5, we're in the Sermon on the Mount. That's the series that we've been going through over the past 9 weeks, and we'll continue for the next however many weeks it takes to get through the whole Sermon on the Mount. And I'm going to give you a quick recap of where we've been and where we're going and how we're going to get there. So if you haven't been here or you missed out or you haven't been paying attention, maybe you'll kind of sort of see where we're at. So the Sermon on the Mount, we've looked at a few things that Jesus has taught his followers, his disciples, and the curious people that gathered around. Remember, we talked about this is a sermon that Jesus did at the beginning of his ministry. It's toward the beginning of his time where he's going to start ministering to people. So he went up on a mountain. He talked to his disciples. He kind of said that you guys are now apostles. He kind of went down a little bit on the mountain. There was a plain on the mountain. A bunch of people had gathered because Jesus was at that time was known. He was Jesus. He was a teacher. He was a prophet. He was a nice guy. People were curious about him. So there were followers. There were curious people. There were his disciples. They were all there. And Jesus starts teaching them. And he's teaching them what's known as the Sermon on the Mount. So he started out, which is the Beatitudes. He started out with what we looked at. Jesus gave the characteristics of someone who is a citizen of heaven and the blessings that come from having those characteristics. That's kind of how we've broken down the Beatitudes. And real quick, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these. I'm going to go point by point. You could go read them yourself or go listen to podcasts online or whatever. But the characteristics and the blessings that Jesus said someone needs to be a citizen of heaven is, number one, you have to be poor in spirit. And if you're poor in spirit, you get the kingdom of heaven. And I'm going to do my best to bite my tongue and not explain each one. So if I start explaining one, slap me because we don't have time to go through every one of them. Go back and listen. And if you've been here, you understand. It should recall what we've talked about. So poor in spirit, you get the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said we need to be mournful, and if we're mournful, we'll be comforted. Mournful over our sin means we get comfort. We need to be meek, and if we're meek, we inherit the earth. We need to hunger and thirst for righteousness, and if we do that, we're satisfied. Another characteristic is merciful, and if we are merciful, we get mercy. We need to be pure in heart. If we're pure in heart, we see God. We need to be peacemakers. If we are peacemakers, we get to be called sons of God. And one of the blessings, one of the characteristics is we're persecuted. And if we're persecuted, again, we get the kingdom of heaven. Those are the characteristics and the blessings that are wrapped around the characteristics of someone who needs to be a follower of Jesus. If you want to be a follower of Jesus, those are the characteristics you need to have. Poor in spirit, mournful, meek, hunger and thirst for righteousness, merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, and persecuted. And if you have those things, you get the blessings that I mentioned, and you are a citizen of heaven. We also looked at how each one of those characteristics, it's not a smorgasbord where you get to choose a few of them and say, I'm really good at this one, and I'm really good at this one, so I'm pretty good. They all build upon one another, and they're all connected. So if you're poor in spirit, you're going to be mournful, which is going to lead to meekness, and so on and so on. They all build upon each other. Jesus said, those are the characteristics of someone who follows me, who someone who gets to inherit the kingdom of heaven is going to be that. Okay? So after we went through 8 weeks of that and discussing each one of those, we looked last week at what someone who is a follower of Jesus, someone who has those characteristics and is a follower of Jesus, what then they are to do with that information. It'd be really easy for Jesus to say, hey, listen, the world is a bad, bad place. It's a nasty place. It's bad now. It was bad then. It's going to be bad in the future. We live in a fallen world. The world was perfect when God made it. It was good, but Adam and Eve sinned, and when they did, the world basically broke. It's broken, and it's not going to be restored until Jesus comes back. And so we live right now. They lived back then. It's a fallen, bad place. And it would have been easy, I think, and probably desirable for God and Jesus to say, hey, listen, get these characteristics, get these blessings, and then come over and let's move into this city all by ourselves with like-minded people so we can just enjoy each other and not worry about the fallen world. And let's just sit here and wait for Jesus to come back, because I don't like the world, because the world is nasty and scary, and there's bad things happening in it. That would have been people would have said, yeah, I can take that, because I do live in the world, and there are people that are doing bad and evil and nasty things, and I want to remove myself from the world. But Jesus, in his infinite wisdom, if you want to look at it that way, said, okay, you're a believer, here's the next thing that you're going to do. You're going to be salt and light to the world. You're not to go separate yourself from the world. You're supposed to go influence the world. And so last week we looked at the two things that Jesus called us to be as believers, salt and light. And again, I'm going to do my best to not go over those in great detail, but you can go listen and go read and figure it out. But salt is a good thing. Light is a good thing. We're to go into the world and be salt and light to the world. And we looked at how Jesus said the good that's happening in the world, the nice things that happen in the world, are because Christians are salt and light in the world. If it wasn't, we looked at this, if it wasn't for us, things would be even worse. Which is why we as Christians need to resist the temptation to separate ourselves from the world because it's so nasty out there. Does that make sense? And I'm sorry I just said that, but I want to make sure you understand what I'm saying. I point at my wife because she gets mad at me when I say, does that make sense? But we have a tendency as Christians to look at the outside world and say, ugh, it's horrible. So I'm going to withdraw into a bunch of people that believe just like me and think just like me. And we're going to get together and we're just going to bemoan how bad the world has become. And we're just going to sit there and say, oh, this is horrible. I wish Jesus would just come back already. He's got to come back now. I mean, look at what's happening. But Jesus is saying, yeah, that's all true, but get out there and go be salt and light. Go influence the world for good, because the only good that's in the world is the influence that you're having on it. So go do it. So we have the characteristics of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, and then we have our responsibility is to go be an influence in the world. We're to be salt and light in the world. So Jesus then moves on in his Sermon on the Mount, and he is getting ready to describe the righteousness that comes from the kingdom and how followers are to be righteous and how that contrasts with the righteousness of the leaders of that day. And we'll look at that probably more next week than we will this week. We're going to kind of get an introduction into that. But Jesus went from the characteristics to the influence, and now he's going to start talking about righteousness and the righteousness that we are supposed to have as believers. We're just going to start in Matthew 5, 17. This is where we left off. We're in Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, and hopefully we'll start coming together. It says, do not think, this is Jesus talking. He just went over the characteristics. He just said, you're going to be salt and light. And then Jesus says this, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one iota, not a dot, will pass away from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Amen? Amen. We're going to rest there for a little bit. Jesus, and like I said at the beginning, Jesus has already been creating a buzz among the people. He was known as a great teacher. He was known as someone who was teaching cool things and healing people, and people were following him around. He was a new guy, a new cool teacher. And because of that, people were wondering exactly what was going on with him, and that's why there was a crowd of people listening to him during this Sermon on the Mount. Okay? Again, he was known as a great teacher. He was a possible healer. Could he be the Messiah? There were people that at the beginning said, hey, the Messiah is here. Nobody knew, and so that's what drew people to him. And a couple things to be aware of before we get into what Jesus just said. There is a time in biblical studies known as the intertestamental period. That's the time between the Old Testament and the New Testament. So you have the Old Testament, and it ends in Jeremiah. And then there's a time of a few hundred years, a few centuries, where nothing is written, there's nothing going on, and then the New Testament starts. And that's called the intertestamental period. There's stuff that goes on, but there's no books, there's no writings about what God was doing that we read, that we say is Scripture. Okay? And during that time, and into the time that the New Testament had started, there were numerous guys that came up and said, I'm the Messiah. numerous. You can go read about them. Go Google false messiahs during the Old Testament, false messiahs during the New Testament, and you could read about them. There were numerous guys that came about and said, I'm the Messiah. I'm the guy that's been prophesied about in the Old Testament. It's me. Come follow me. And people would come and say, wow, this guy's cool. He's saying all the right things. He's a little weird, but he's saying all the right things. This is awesome. And he would make all these promises, and then he would die. And then another guy would come along and say, hey, it's me, the Messiah. I'm the one that was prophesied about. Come follow me. It's me. It's me. And the same thing would happen. He would draw a crowd, and he would die. That was going on all the, I won't say all the time, but numerous times during that period, there were guys coming out saying, I'm the Messiah. I'm the guy that was prophesied about. And they turned out to be false messiahs. So, put yourself in the position of the people when Jesus is on the mountain speaking. Some of them probably had heard about some of these false messiahs. Maybe some of them have actually followed some of the false messiahs only to be disappointed, and now they're on the sermon, or they're on the mountain listening to Jesus give a sermon. That's what's going on. That's what's happening when Jesus is saying these things. There are people that are wondering, is he who he says he is? He hasn't even said who he is yet. Who is this guy? There are some people that say he's the Messiah. There are some people that say he's a great teacher. There are some people that say he's just a nice guy that makes nice chairs. There's some people that say, what's going on here? We got to go find out. That's what's going on during this time. So Jesus is speaking to those people when he's saying these things. Okay? Again, they were amazed and curious about a guy named Jesus, Joseph and Mary's son. What were the people saying about him? Was it true? People had questions, they wondered, they were skeptical. There's always skepticism of someone who announces, I'm the guy. Okay? And there is still, today, skepticism about who Jesus is among the outside world and even, let's be honest, among Christians. Okay? Is he a nice guy? Is he a great moral teacher? Is he a mystic? Is he another prophet? If you read the Quran, they put Jesus in there, but they just say he's just another prophet. He's just like in a line of other prophets. He's a nice guy. He's a prophet, but he's not the prophet. He's just a prophet. So there's all these questions about who Jesus is. Still today, it happens. It wasn't just back then that people were questioning, is this guy the guy? Is he really who he says he is? It still goes on today. And there's a great quote in a great book called Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. If you haven't read it, I encourage you to read it and then read it again and again and again. If you want to defend your faith, if you get scared of, I want to tell people about Jesus, but I'm afraid somebody's going to come at me with some facts and questions and I'm not going to know how to answer them, read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, because it really is a good book on apologetics, which sounds like you're apologizing, but you're not. It's more of a defense. You say this about Jesus, here's what I can say, and C.S. Lewis is quite smart. And quite ingenious in the way he comes at things. And here's what he says about people wondering who Jesus is and everything. He says this. He says, I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would be either a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. That's good. That we could stop right there and that'd be good enough for me to get out. That's good stuff right there. So Jesus is speaking to these people who were skeptical of who he was. And he's wanting to announce in this Sermon on the Mount, sort of, hey, listen, this is who I am, and here's why I am, that stuff. So Jesus, after giving his instruction on what it's needed to be a child of God, and what kind of influence that we're to have on the world, before going into the type of righteousness the kingdom has, he's going to address his relationship with the law and the prophets. He's going to address who he is and why he can say the things he's going to say. Okay? And this is how he starts. He says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets." Now, if we were doing a paper in college, or you were doing some kind of paper, you would want it to have kind of a flow. This is where it kind of goes out into left field for me as an English major. Here's the characteristics. Here's the influence. Hang on a second. I got to come over here and tell you something. He's kind of moving to something totally different. Now he's going to come back probably next week when we'll start going, and you'll see that, oh, this kind of flows. Boom, boom, boom. But for some reason, he skipped a boom and went over here to deliver a big one. To say, wait a second, do not think that I came to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. That's the Matthew 5:17. Here, we see Jesus answering a question that must have been out there. He wouldn't have said this unless he knew that people were saying this about him. If you really look at what he said, do not think that I came to abolish the law and the prophets. So people must have been saying, oh, this is one of those guys who's going to say that the law and the prophets don't make a difference anymore. Maybe there was someone before Jesus who said the same thing, that the new Messiah is going to come and he's going to abolish all the rules that we had before, and he's going to set up new, and I just want to know what's going on. So Jesus is answering a question that must have been circulating or whispered about. Jesus came to change everything. Some must have said that he was going to do away with the law and the prophets for him to say, I'm not going to do away with the law and the prophets. Right? Someone must have been saying that for him to say, I'm not going to do that. Because if he just said that, that'd be like me just coming out and saying, I like cheese for no reason. What did that have to do with anything? You know, he was answering a question that must have been out there. There were a lot of people that thought that the Messiah, when he came, that he was going to set up his rule on earth instantly. That I'm the Messiah, boom, everything's perfect, the Israelites are now ruling, the Messiah was going to be a militaristic leader, and all the enemies were going to fall instantly, and that was what a lot of people expected also the Messiah to do. So Jesus is trying to say, hey, listen, I'm going to tell you how things are really going to work here. So Jesus starts to set the record straight right here after telling people what it means to be a Christian and what it means, what your influence is supposed to be. He's going to start to set the record straight. He's going to say that the law and the prophets, which we could refer to as the Old Testament, there's other parts in there, but he's talking about the law and the prophets, it's not going to be abolished or destroyed by Jesus. It's going to be fulfilled by Jesus. When he says this, when Jesus says this, this is his first hint at who he is. That when he says he's going to fulfill the law and the prophets, the people listening that were religious at that time, that understood what that meant, that's when their ears perked up. This is probably when it started, that Jesus started to be on the radar of the religious leaders of the days for him saying this kind of stuff. Because you don't say that unless you're the Messiah. We know, because we know the Old Testament, New Testament, we've been in church long enough, most of us have, we know what he's talking about. But again, think about what was happening in that day. Most of the people sitting there listening probably didn't have a great understanding of Old Testament, there was no New Testament, Old Testament and stuff like that. But the religious leaders did, and when he says this, some of them started to say, we're putting this guy on our radar. He's another one of those dudes. He's another one of those guys. Okay? The Pharisees, the Sadducees, those type of religious leaders. Now, I want to give you a quick history lesson on the Pharisees and Sadducees. Are they bad people? Yeah. Do we not like them? No. Why? Because Jesus says we shouldn't, because they're more concerned with the outside appearance and putting on a show. But you need to understand, I like to look at, why would they do this? We have the whole Bible, so we know how it begins and how it ends, and we know who Jesus is, and we say, how could the Pharisees be so stupid? How could they not recognize that Jesus is Jesus, that he's the Messiah? How could they not recognize that he was going to do all the things he did? They had all the signs. But the Pharisees, again, had been living in a time where they've already been dealing with false prophets. There were already a bunch of people that came out and said, I'm the guy, and turned out not to be the guy. What made Jesus special? Was it his birth? Place? Was it his lineage? I mean, he had nothing special that they knew of that to say, hey, wait, this is the guy. There's already been 20 or 30 this month, this year, but this is the one because look how pretty he is. So why would the Pharisees and the religious leaders of that day believe in him? But let's be honest, we wouldn't have. If we're honest, we wouldn't have either. He's another one of those guys. And the Pharisees grew out of a group, and let's go back to the Old Testament and the intertestamental period. We know that the Israelites had a tough time of it. They would follow God, they wouldn't follow God, they would follow God, they wouldn't follow God, and every time they didn't follow God, bad things would happen to them. They would get defeated by some army. Some group would come in and they would say, okay, all the Jewish people, you can't live here anymore. And they'd send them into exile. And then they'd come back. And then this was happening decades and decades and decades of them being moved and changed and new people coming in. And a lot of times when a country or a group defeated another group, what would happen is that country would come in, and basically that country was now their country, and all the customs and all the things that that country, the winning side, did would start to influence the country that they defeated. So, and I use these as, I don't know about the food, but think about that. If Mexico were to defeat the United States, we'd all be eating a lot more tacos probably soon. That's just what happened. Okay? It would happen. New flags would be put up. The way we talk would probably be influenced. We'd probably have to trill our... I mean, that's just what happens. That's what happens when countries defeat other countries. And also what happens is that influence of culture from one culture defeating another culture, it influences every part of that culture, including religion, including the religious beliefs of that day. And there was a group of Jewish people back in those days that every time Israel was defeated, every time that Israel was put into exile, every time that something bad happened to Israel and people started to influence the Jewish culture, there was a group of people that said, you are not touching God. You're not touching the law and you're not touching the prophets. No, we're not going to let you bring in another statue into our worship. No, you can't come and sacrifice anything the way we do it because God has set up these parameters and we're going to defend it. Sometimes to the death. Sometimes they fought and had wars over people just trying to assimilate their religious beliefs into the culture that defeated them. There was a small group of Jewish people that said, absolutely not. I'm standing up for God because what God says is true. Do we like those people? I mean, those people are brave. Those people are cool. That's who the Pharisees were. That same group that did that in the Old Testament and the intertestamental period are now the Pharisees. They're the ones that stood up and said, no, we're not letting anyone influence our beliefs that are from the outside. It's got to be pure. It's got to be what God said so. So you can kind of sort of see why they might be a little negative towards Jesus when he starts talking like this. Now again, it's easy for us to say, well, they should have. Well, sure, they should have, but they didn't because they lived in a time where there were a bunch of false prophets going on. So maybe when you look at the Pharisees from now on, they're still bad. We still don't like them. But there, to me, there's a little tinge of, I can understand where they're coming from. I can understand why they would do what they did. Because they were trying to protect, maybe with the wrong type of heart, which we know now because that's what Jesus said, but they were trying to protect the faith that God had set up for them for such a long time. So, And I looked at it like the Pharisees were religious gatekeepers. This is what God said. That's it. We're not going to let anything else get in the way of that. So when Jesus comes and starts saying the things he's starting to say in the Sermon on the Mount, that's when their radar goes up. Now, if you want to get really deep, you can start saying, well, wait a second. Do you mean God? Look how amazing God is to be involved in everything that happened with Israel and setting up this small group of people that were going to defend the faith and then also be the small group of people that were going to be the ones that were going to crucify Jesus and kill him. But he didn't really get killed. He gave his life because that group did what they did. And man, God is amazing that he could weave his story all through everything that's going on. That's just kind of amazing. So again, Jesus is starting to say these things. And so to the religious leaders of the day, here comes another crazy person. saying these crazy things, and we got to be on our lookout. So Jesus starts this section, like we said, to alleviate the fears, unsuccessfully for many of them, that he was coming to undo or eliminate the religious leaders and the message, the law, and the prophets of that time. The law and the prophets that Jesus is talking about is the Old Testament. Here's what the law and the prophets foretold that Jesus was talking about. And I'm going to give you just a few of them. Number one, the law and the prophets foretold of a coming Messiah. Okay, that's what the law and the prophets did. There's over 300 prophecies. We've talked about this before. It could be 100, it could be 300, it could be 500, depending on how you slice up the prophecies. But for the most part, most people will say there's about 330 prophecies of the Messiah in the Old Testament, and Jesus fulfilled every one of them. It's not like he fulfilled 5 or 10. He fulfilled every one of them. The odds of him doing that were astronomically impossible, and he did it anyway. And I'm going to give you a couple. In Deuteronomy 18:15, it says this: "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. And Isaiah, I'm going to read just a couple. I don't have time to read all of them. Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 12. I'll read this one. And when I read this, you'll understand this one. You know this. "Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of a dry ground. For he had no form of majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by man, a man of sorrows, and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hid their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. And we like sheep have gone astray, we have turned, every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people, and they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressor." If you don't know, that's talking about Jesus. That's talking about the Messiah. The law and the prophets foretell of the coming kingdom of God. Daniel chapter 2 verse 44 says this. Daniel 2:44. "And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to the end, and it shall stand forever." The law and the prophets foretold of a new covenant. Jeremiah 31, verse 31, 31 through 34. Jeremiah 31, 31 says this. This is a new covenant coming. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." Okay? Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount that he's not coming against the law and prophets. In fact, he's fulfilling them. Everything that we just talked about, that the law and the prophets talk about, finds its fulfillment in Jesus. That's what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, "I'm not changing it. I'm not overriding it. I'm not eliminating it. I'm not coming against it. I am what the law and the prophets were talking about. It's me. I'm here to fulfill what was promised. He, in essence, is saying that the law and the prophets that you have been reading, they all point to the Messiah. And hint, hint, that's me. He doesn't come right out and say that yet, but that's what he's saying. And that's when smart people who know the Old Testament back in those days, their ears perked up and said, okay, let's watch this guy. Okay? Jesus had already been hinting about this already. In Mark chapter 1, 14 and 15, he says this. Now after John was arrested, Jesus came into Galilee, proclaiming the gospel of God and saying, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. The law and the prophets are fulfilled in Jesus. That's what he's trying to say in that one sentence that we just covered. One verse, that's what he's saying. That the law and the prophets, I'm not abolishing them, I am them. I'm fulfilling them. I'm the one that's completing what God had wanted to do. So Matthew 5, 17 through 19, again it says this, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Jesus saying that is not only earth-shattering, but to many who heard it, it was blasphemy. Because he's another one of those kooky guys that says the same thing that we've heard over and over again that wind up not being who he said he is. So it's earth-shattering for those that believe that he is saying, I'm the Messiah. And for those that don't want to believe, it's blasphemy. It's bad. Okay? That's what Jesus is setting up. And then real quick, give me 3 minutes. He adds verses 18 and 19. And he says, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until it is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. When Jesus says, for truly I say to you, I'm not going to get too deep into this because I want to make sure I get done fairly decently in a time that's not crazy. But basically what that is, that phrase is a statement of what's known as, by scholars, supreme legislative authority. For truly I say to you is like a guy that has supreme legislative authority. So it's not just the dude from, you know, Mary and Joseph's son saying it. It's someone with supreme legislative authority saying what he's saying. So he's saying, I'm not come to abolish these things. I've come to fulfill them. And everything I'm saying, I could say that thing because I have the authority to say those things because I have supreme legislative authority. Hint, hint, I'm God. If you really want to take it a step further. He's hinting at who he is right here. He's saying that I have supreme authority. The king is speaking. I'm speaking about the law. It's not going anywhere until everything that needs to be accomplished is accomplished. That's what he's saying if you keep reading those things. The law, the prophets, they're God's law and the prophets, and they're to be taken seriously. Says who? Says the guy with supreme legislative authority. And here's where we have two places we could go with this. You can say, when Jesus says it is accomplished, he's saying, nothing's going to pass away from the law. Nothing's going to change about the law and the prophets until it is finished, until it's accomplished. He said, it's not one dot, not one I, not one cross T. That's what he's mean. Not one small word is going to pass away until it is accomplished. When he says is it accomplished, is Jesus talking about what happened on the cross in John 19:30 when he says this. When Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. So when Jesus said it is finished, is it finished? Was it accomplished? Is that what he's talking about here? Is Jesus saying that once I say it is finished on the cross, it is accomplished, it's done, it's paid in full. Is that what I'm talking about? Is that what he's talking about? So Jesus here could be speaking to his followers and the disciples and the religious leaders of the day, saying, until it is finished, when Jesus said so on the cross, the leaders were to not stop teaching the law and the prophets until it was accomplished, and it was accomplished when Jesus died on the cross. And so therefore, the law and the prophets are basically done. We don't teach that anymore, we teach Jesus. You could go that direction. And I'm going to tell you where I think we can go, and we'll go from there. So that's what he's saying. So Jesus could be saying that when he's saying, hey, the law and the prophets, not one dot's going to pass away until it's finished. Now we know the end. He finished it because he said so. He said it is finished. So is he saying, Jesus saying that now, since he's finished it, is the Old Testament just, is it done? And we just now focus on Jesus. Or, when Jesus is talking about the law and the commandments until it is finished and accomplished, he is not just talking about his death and resurrection when he says it is finished at the cross. He's also talking about when it's finished, finished. Because even though it's finished, it's not finished because he's not come back yet. So, that's where, if you were going to go where I went when I was teaching it, what is he saying here? Is he saying that the law and the prophets, they're done? And it's finished because he did it on the cross and we're finished? Or is he saying, it's finished, but there's still more to be finished, so I'm not really finished, it's got to be finished, finished. And so the Old Testament and the prophets, we still have to worry about those things. Because what he says here is, he's saying, listen, if we're taking the second case that it's not yet finished, then we need to be careful, correct? Because he's saying not one dot will pass away. And if you teach somebody to relax one dot, it's not good. So as a Christian, you're saying, okay, wait a second, where do I go with this? Is it finished or is it not finished? I could just leave right there and we'll just go home and say that. Most people are going to lean toward, when I say most people, most scholars, most people are going to lean towards the first scenario, that it's finished. And that the Old Testament, and I say this and I'm saying it for lack of a better word, is done. It's found its fulfillment in Jesus. So now we teach Jesus. But it's still not finished, finished, because he still hasn't come back to change what's going on here. So I'll realize I would lean more towards the first scenario. It is finished and we no longer live by the Old Testament laws, because we don't. We don't need to, because Jesus fulfilled them, so we now live in the new covenant that Jesus talked about. If you go read Hebrews, you can read all about what the new covenant is and how it's a new thing, that we now live under a new covenant, not the old covenant. I mean, we read some verses in that already. So we're not bound by the old covenant anymore, we're bound by the new covenant, that's what we teach. But in teaching all there is to know about God, I believe we're not supposed to ignore the Old Testament. We can't preach what's known as the whole counsel of God and ignore more than half the Bible. Because the Old Testament points towards Jesus. So you can't know Jesus unless you know what the Old Testament is about. Why, if you ignored the Old Testament, you wouldn't know why Jesus died on a cross. You wouldn't know why he needed to die on a cross. You wouldn't know why there's sin in the world. So while yes, it's finished and it's accomplished and we now live in the New Testament and the New Covenant, we still need to have the Old Covenant and teach it, because it's the whole counsel of God and it points us all towards Jesus. So we're not teaching the Old Testament to say, here's the list of rules that you need to do and here's the things, the do nots and the do's and the shoulds and should nots. We don't live in that anymore. We have Jesus who did it for us and fulfilled it, so now we just focus on Jesus. But we don't ignore the Old Testament because we have to teach it to point people towards Jesus. I hope that makes sense. And I know it does. And I didn't say, does that make sense? I said, I hope it makes sense. Okay? So, we need to know that Jesus is Jesus. He's not just a nice guy. He's not just a preacher or a teacher or some mystic or even some healer or just another line of prophets that crop up every now and then that people could follow. Jesus is the Son of God who fulfilled every prophecy in the Old Testament, and that's sort of kind of what he's hinting at and saying when he starts off this section of the Sermon on the Mount, when he's going to start talking about righteousness. He's saying, listen, I have supreme legislative authority to talk like this. I just gave you the characteristics. I just gave you the influence you have. I'm getting ready to tell you about the righteousness that you're supposed to have. And maybe he looked out in the crowd. You know how I said it kind of sort of took a thing? Maybe he looked out of the crowd and there were some people going like this, like, who are you to be telling us this? And he's like, okay, hang on. You want me to tell you who I am? I didn't come to do this. I came to do this. And I have the authority to do this because, hint, hint, I'm God and you need to listen to me. So as we go into the next section, you could rest assured that Jesus is who he says he is, and he's God. He's the Messiah. He's not just some nice guy that we listen to that puts down some nice things and say, hey, why don't you try to do this and be all happy and good. He's saying, I'm God, I'm the Messiah, you come to me, and that's what he's going to be talking about. So